Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to the Third Coast Podcast. I'm Katie Mingle. You'll hear our weekly radio show, Resound, here, as well as the occasional story curated recently from our audio library at thirdcoastfestival.org. The Third Coast Festival is a nonprofit organization whose livelihood depends in part on support from listeners like you. To find out how you can help or to check out all of the cool stuff we do apart from our radio show, visit our website, thirdcoastfestival.org. Thanks and enjoy the podcast.
Okay, let's see what we have here.
From the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago, I'm Gwen Maxey.
Craigslist.
And this is Resound.
Jobs, housing, personals, no, okay. Craigslist community, lost and found, that's the one.
Lost white parakeet, last seen flying towards the Fox River from Randall Road in South Elgin. Her family and other parakeet friends misses her.
Lost Blackberry, Lost Jesus Bracelet.
Resound is a remix of radio stories, documentaries, music, found sound, and sound bites we find all over the world.
I lost an envelope of rent money this weekend.
Good luck on that one.
I know this is a long shot, but I'm hoping someone has found it.
On the air, on the web, into the void, we listen to everything we can get our ears on and bring you the best of what we hear each week on Resound.
Found. Lady's wallet.
Trying to locate my father, who was named John.
Lost cat, weird leg, bad eyes. Responds to the name Yoda. He's very old and I'm sure very scared. If you find him, please call blah blah blah. Oh, these are very sad.
You can find almost anything in the lost and found, but there are some things you will never see in those listings. Lost love, lost bearings, found dignity. These are hard for some of us to even perceive, let alone retrieve. And putting a price on them? Forget about it. Today on Resound, searching for the intangible. What's been lost and what might be found. Stay with us. Cultures are easy to lose by force, by dispersion, by neglect. And bringing an entire culture back from the brink is a Herculean task. But one good place to start is the language. For nearly 1,000 years, the Hopi people have lived on the same three mesas in northern Arizona. And while they have deep roots there, their language has been gradually fading away.
Since the beginning, we have been taught about the end. When our language dies, we are told that the world will begin dying with it.
We have a prophecy that one night, lost brothers will awaken from the dead.
Then they'll draw a line
from one end of the village to the other. One by one, they will line us up, and then they will ask us, Hopi te kaita, Hopi. Are you Hopi? Can you speak the Hopi language? And if we cannot respond back in full in Hopi, they will place us on the right side of the line. And soon after that, they will cut our throats. This is what we call Judgment Day.
This is our school, the Hopi Junior Senior High School. Our Hopi language is dying, and me and most of my friends are struggling to speak it.
When I talk to my friends, we speak English. We don't, like, speak our Hopi language. Or because some of my friends aren't Hopi, others are, but they don't really know how to speak it.
I'm just terrified that if I don't speak, like right now, everything that I know that I've been doing won't really matter because I lost my culture and my language already.
It's a scary thought that our culture is all dependent on our generation. Our culture's dying, and there's nothing we can do to save it because nobody wants to take the time to learn our language. It's going to have no significance. It's not going to have any importance after all our elders are gone.
This problem isn't new to our generation.
I'm 66 years old.
Hopi stopped learning our language.
I wasn't allowed to speak my language.
When they were punished for speaking it in schools.
You're afraid, you're ashamed, and you're crying, and they tell you to stop crying and hit you. But how can you stop crying when they hit you?
That's what happened to my grandmother,
Eloise Komolistua Kuchemtua. And I'm Austin Kuchemtua's grandma.
She stopped teaching her children.
I regret it now.
To protect them from suffering the same humiliation that she had to endure when she was in school.
I remember holding on to a fence, just crying. And then my dad would be dragging me to the classroom. It was so scary to sit there. That's what happened to me. That's why I didn't teach my kids.
Remember the part, remember when we were sitting there doing laundry and I asked you, how do you say this? How do you say that? What's the word for up, down? Where did you go? Things like that.
Oh, yeah. And I told him, even if you can't pronounce it right, at least I'll know what you're trying to say. You know, that way I can help you. I can correct you. I just hope you don't die. Don't die because... that's the only thing we have right now is our language and our ceremonies. But it's not too late. It's not too late.
There's two kind of people here. There's one to destroy everything of Hopi, even the language, and then there's the others to preserve it.
This is Leon Carew.
I am 48 years old.
He is the spokesperson for the religious leaders of the Masangnavi village.
If you want to lose the language, then you don't learn it. You don't speak it. You don't teach it on to the next one.
Lots of young people don't want to speak the language in front of their elders because they say the elders make fun of them.
It's scary when you're trying to talk to older people, I guess, because they tease a lot. And we take it personally, and we don't want to speak it no more.
Sometimes the Hopi will say, making fun of you should also get you to say, okay, I'm going to better myself. Even though if the children are having a hard time, they shouldn't stop because they're the ones that are going to carry this language on. There's really no choice unless we want to, you know, forget who we are.
At our school, there's only one student who is fluent in Hopi.
His name is Arai Polikweptewa.
And everyone calls him Hopi Boy.
Hopi Boy.
Hopi Boy.
Hopi lawe te kaewe kamakpa ayulalaengo. You never forget a language that you first learn.
The thing that makes Arai different from everyone else is that his parents forced him to speak Hopi.
I learned the language from my parents. When I was just a te pusuya, little baby, that's all he talked to me in was Hopi. And Hopi was supposed to be the first language you'll ever learn.
Some people made fun of Alroy when we were younger because he had a traditional haircut and spoke the language so well.
Number one, Hopi boy coming through the door. I guess they admired me, but I thought they were like teasing me.
I kind of looked up to him because he knew Hopi, and I started to learn words from him, and I started learning, and just started popping in my head, and I started getting an idea of what people are talking about.
Later on, as I wondered, why be like them when I can be myself and be different? And then I did that, and I became a role model. Oha, oha, hey.
The land of the Hopi is the center of the universe. We have lived on these three mesas for generations. And all that while, our people have been speaking the Hopi language. But now everybody says our language is dying.
That was Last Words from Hopi High, produced by Brett Myers of Youth Media International, with the students of Hopi High in Keams Canyon, Arizona. To see pictures of some of the Hopi High students, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. Much has been written about lost youth. Among my favorite quips, inside every old person is a young person wondering what happened. At the Lillian Booth Home in New Jersey, inside every quote-unquote old person, there's a Ziegfeld dancer, actor, vaudevillian, comedian, bandleader, or set designer. The home is for retired folks who used to work in the entertainment industry. And while it might not be Broadway, the footlights are still burning. Here's Waiting for Godot in New Jersey.
Where did we start at the 12:05?
Let's go.
We can't.
Why not?
We're waiting for Godot.
Oh, are you sure it was here?
He said by the tree. Do you see any others?
What is it?
I don't know. A willow.
Where are the leaves?
Must be dead.
No more weeping.
Or perhaps it's not the season.
Looks to me like a bush.
A shrub.
A bush.
What are you insinuating, that we've come to the wrong place?
Well, he should be here.
He didn't say for sure he'd come.
Well, I'll tell you, as long as there's a telephone, no actor is ever retired.
Actors Fund Home, how can I help you? Sure, hold on 1 second.
I hope you're not going to be too depressed coming to a nursing home. My name is Bill Story. I've been around a long time. I'm 83 years old. And I've been in the theater since I was 17. You can figure that out.
My name is Minette Vinson O'Gorick. Minette Vinson was my professional name.
My name is Alex Reed.
My name is Aideen O'Kelly. We're in the actor's home in Englewood, New Jersey. When I came here about 2.5 years ago, I didn't want to be here. It's not home. Can't be. Home is where my spirit is. You see, I'm an actor, well, up to recently, because my sight's going. Home was on a stage. I'm sorry, but it's the truth. That was home. What can I tell you? That was my joy.
No, there's nothing like the stage. Nothing. Give me a part on the stage first.
The pleasure of just getting your feet on that stage and feeling it under you. It's quivery, you know. It's just so wonderful.
You know exactly when they're right with you. And boy, what a great feeling that is. I go down here before every meal to the pill room. Yeah, I call it 42nd Street to 57th. From here to my room, which I do 4 or 5 times a day. I take 13 pills a day. Don't ask me what for.
This is the main room for shows and various forms of entertainment. In this particular room where we're standing now, see the lights?
Listen.
I hear nothing.
Shh. Nor I.
You gave me a fright.
I thought it was he.
Who?
Godot.
Oh, the wind in the reeds.
I could have sworn I heard shouts.
And why would he shout?
At his horse.
This is something I don't understand. You say that the happy time was just like this.
Exactly. And it's sort of, well, having no time and all the time in the world. And as we know, we talk all the time, that every single word we utter, there's something behind it. It means something.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you say he was adamant about every single word.
Oh, boy, dare you change a syllable. No way.
You just told me you met Samuel Beckett.
Yes. We were doing Happy Days, and we went to Paris to meet Mr. Beckett. Oh, honestly, I'll never forget that. Here I was sitting in this room, and Mr. Beckett walked in. I was so, not enthralled, I was terrified. And you know, he's very tall and very thin. And these piercing gray eyes. When you look into those, you're, oh my Lord. I imagine you could never tell him a lie, ever. And he says, Adrian, you're going to do my play. Could you read to me? I nearly died. And after about 20 minutes, I stopped. And he said, this is all wrong, all wrong, all wrong. I was dying. Mr. Beckett, what do I do? He said, you're too capable. Winnie is fragile. And we tried again. He sat down in front of me and he read with me. I started to laugh. And he looked at me and said, what are you laughing at? You? I said, you're so funny. Well, that was it. He loved me after that because I got it. It was funny. I was devastated with the beauty of this man. Oh, my God.
Well, this is the main dining room here. Very nice. We have breakfast, lunch, and dinner in here. You know, it's not a cafeteria at all. We sit down and they serve us very nicely. The food is good. So it's a nice place to be. I see today's the 17th. And it's a what? Tuesday. Okay.
He said Saturday, I think.
You think?
I must have made a note of it.
But what Saturday? And is it Saturday? Is it not rather Sunday or Monday? Or Friday?
It's not possible.
Well, if he came yesterday and we weren't here, you may be sure that he won't come again today.
But you say we were here yesterday.
I may be mistaken. Well, let's stop talking for a minute. Do you mind?
All right.
Oh, hello. Roberta, how are you? Thank you, darling. So, this is where I ate with Minette.
Minette Vincent was my professional name. I was a synchronized swimmer with my twin sister, the Vincent twins. And we were the very first synchronized swimmers to travel and work professionally in water shows around the country. This was in 1950. That was 60 years ago, or longer. Was it longer, 60 years from 1950, yes, okay. And we were really the first. We did a routine called Two Tired Kittens, and we swam doing movements of sleepies. Dum 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 dum. Ah, ah. You know how you yawn and you put your hand up to your mouth? Well, that's what we do. We would put our hand up to our mouth and then reach out for a stroke, either a back stroke, side stroke, or front stroke. So the yawn was visible, and those were the sleepy kittens. And we had black bathing suits and little hats with ears on them and everything. I've always heard the kittens don't like the water, but we loved it. And I've asked them to put in a pool for me here, but they just haven't been forthcoming. They said they don't have the space.
I was asking if we're tied.
Tied? How do you mean tied?
Down.
But to whom? By whom?
To your man.
To Godot? Tied to Godot? What an idea, no question of it. For the moment.
His name is Godot?
I think so.
Beckett was not a religious person. He didn't believe in God, apparently. And this impossible journey towards a Godot, the person who never comes, in Beckett's opinion.
How does it end? What is the ending?
Was the whole... Isn't that curious? I don't
remember how it ended.
I don't either.
Aideen, do you remember any of your lines from Happy Days?
All I can tell you about that is that the last line of it is la da dee da dee da dee la dee dee dee. That's the end of the play. Oh boy. It probably was the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life.
Waiting for Godot in New Jersey by Pike Malinowski. The story originally aired on WNYC's Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson. To hear more stories by Pike, visit thirdcoastfestival.org.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Jay Allison, public radio lifer, founder of Transom.org and the Public Radio Exchange and other public radio type things. If you like Third Coast Resound, and it is a great place for hearing stories that you won't find anywhere else, you might be interested in hearing the bigger picture, to mix metaphors, and I suggest you check out thirdcoastfestival.org, where you can arrange to have New documentaries sent to you every other week. Find out about listening events, and you can even support them if you're that kind of person. And I hope you are. It's thirdcoastfestival.org. Thanks.
Chicago. All right, let's see what we got. Found male black and white spotted large dog.
Lost. Military ID card and wedding ring.
Keys lost in Wrigleyville. Found blue ball. Lost it.
Military ID card and wedding ring were lost at U.S. Cellular Field during a game on June 24th.
Kitten, iPhone.
Any information on the whereabouts of these items would be much appreciated.
When a depressed city empties out, factories closing, stores boarding up, friends and neighbors migrating elsewhere, a shadow of the once vibrant place remains. Gary, Indiana was named after the founding chairman of U.S. Steel, Elbert H. Gary. And, as you might have guessed, the town's history has been closely intertwined with the rise and fall of the steel industry. When it boomed, Gary boomed. And when it busted, well, so did the city. Producer Robin Amer collected stories and impressions of Gary's semi-abandoned downtown.
Hello, Gary. Do you read Gary?
She focused on the once glamorous Palace Theater, where the Jackson 5, Gary's second largest export, used to perform.
Where's Gary? Has anyone seen Gary?
Well, the thing about Gary, Indiana, at first that I noticed, I was so occupied elsewhere because I had to use the bathroom. So I was just like, oh, really, really interesting, but oh, Kentucky Fried Chicken. And then we stopped there, and then you were inside for a while, and I kind of began to put the pieces together of what it was that was off-putting about the city. And not off-putting as in a way I didn't like it, but off-putting in a way of I was trying to figure out what it was that was foreign to me or didn't make sense. And I think what it was that it reminded me of a lot of former industrial New England towns where you'll have the infrastructure of, like, the shops and the sidewalks, and there might be, like, abandoned street furniture and everything. And everything is kind of like laid out in a way that is really like logical and welcoming to a lot of pedestrian activity, but there wasn't any. And it also seemed like it was sort of in this time warp, because there were a lot of displays at the stores that were very dated. And so it had this feeling of an abandoned town from like 1970. And I guess the culminating point of that was when we saw the Jackson 5 marquee at that theater. The Jackson 5 sign was really interesting because I have this like love for Jackson 5. And growing up, we used to watch the Jackson 5 cartoon. So when I saw that marquee, at first, when I looked at it, it didn't make sense to me because we were driving to the KFC, I think what we saw in the distance, and it had said Jack and Ive White or something like that. And I think one of the letters on the marquee was off kilter, and so it was kind of like hanging at the bottom. So I felt like I was playing Wheel of Fortune. And it was like that part when Vanna White has to, like, you know, like you guess like the letter is, and then Vanna White turns them around and you win or you don't. But what it's supposed to have said in my mind was Jackson 5 tonight. And then when I was hanging out waiting for you at the KFC, I was kind of like, oh, wait a minute. Like, Michael Jackson hit his solo career in like 79. And that was when he had his first musical video, and I think I learned one time on VH1, I think that was like one of the first music videos, and it was the one where he's dancing around and they show the pictures of his feet, and it's like he's kind of like floating in this like black space of Technicolor. And I just thought, like, wow, that's a long time ago. Like, has it been out there that long? Have they had some kind of reunion tour in the early 80s? Did the town shut down before that happened, like before, you know, he had his solo career, because that's like before I was born, and I'm 26, so that's 28 years ago that sign has been hard to read, falling apart marquee.
The night that Dillinger escaped from the Crown Point jail, you don't know that story, all right? Dillinger was a well-known hoodlum. They finally killed him in Chicago at one of the Rialto Theater, I think it was, something like that. And I had a date with one of the engineers from WIND. We went to the Palace Theater, and when the show was out, of course, we went by bus because cars were kind of a luxury, really. It was in the early 30s, right after the Depression of 29. So we couldn't catch the bus. We'd missed it by a few minutes. So the station itself was in the bank building at 5th and Broadway. So we said, well, let's go up and wait there, because it was an hour for the next bus. So when we got up there, all had broken loose because of this monumental escape from the Crown Point jail by this real well-known hoodlum, Dillinger. And the guy that was on duty needed to go to Crown Point, and would my date take over the Ford? And he said yes. And then he looked at me and said, but what about you? I said, well, I can't go home till the next bus. And he said, well, maybe by that time it'll break. I went down into the kind of a little area and sat down, went to sleep. The next thing I knew, it was 4 o'clock in the morning. Now I'm practically a high schooler. You're not really allowed out that late. But another engineer came on, and he brought me home. So the next morning, Mother was in the kitchen when I came downstairs, and I said, did you hear me come home? She said, no, what time did you come home? I said, well, it was 4 o'clock this morning. She said, what? So I told her what happened, and she said, well, you're all right. And I said, oh, yes, I'm fine. But that was a big deal in those days to have a man break out of the Crown Point jail.
Was about the prettiest theater we had in Gary at that time.
What was nicer about it was like the red carpet?
They had nice carpet. The entrance had a lot of designs in it. The outside had that marquee. There's none like it. The marquee was resembled the one for the Chicago Theater back then, 50 years ago. And then the Grand was right across the street, and the comparison was like, wasn't that whatsoever, yeah. Like a Volkswagen and a Cadillac. I've been living in Gary's in 1945, and my late wife and I used to go there on Sundays back in the 50s after we leave church. We had to go to church so we could go to the Palace Theater and at that time and see whatever shows were on. And that was almost every Sunday.
Did they even have cartoons on?
No, we didn't see the cartoons much at the Palace. That was more of the better movie shows.
That was more like Roy Rogers.
But they didn't show a lot of cowboys, I don't think, at the Palace back then. It was more of the love stories and more of the...
It was a theater that you would bring a date for then, more than it would be just to come in and watch a movie. It was kind of like, this is where you're going to get your big move going.
It was a nice place to go, and you felt comfortable there. And it was a very nice place, and it was attractive at that time. Back then, it was one of the prettiest shows in town.
Hello, Gary. Do you read Gary?
We're looking for Gary.
Copy, please, Gary.
Has anyone seen Gary?
So when you go in these buildings, like, how do you get in? I mean, imagine that the front door isn't just open. It's not like they're inviting people to walk inside, right?
Well, I want to be careful how I phrase this. I don't go into any building, basically, that I can't just walk in. As far as getting into the buildings in Gary, Indiana, I would have to honestly say that, yeah, most of them are wide open. Most of those buildings, they're in such a state of disrepair that if there's not a window or a door, there's almost guaranteed to be a massive hole or some sort of other entrance where you can basically just walk in. It was a very bright day, so the first thing you do when you walk in is it's just pitch black, and even the flashlights, it takes a while for your eyes to adjust. And I remember walking in and basically standing at the stage side looking out, and as my eyes come into focus, just massive hulking, you know, theater, and looking from the stage angle up towards the seats and just realizing how gigantic this place is.
How gigantic is it? Can you try and describe it?
Well, I guess I've read it's 2,500 to 3,000 seats, but it was, you know, typical, I guess, of the large movie theaters of the day where they were just, you know, single balcony that would hold, you know, a large amount of the crowd and then the seats. But the part that to me that made it look even larger was that just about all the seats have been torn out, so you're just seeing this big open space where, you know, you walk into a theater, you got seats, you know, you're kind of it kind of breaks up everything. But just seeing it and wondering, you know, where did everything go? You know, a lot of them are there, but a lot of them are gone.
So, but what kind of shape is stuff in? Like, had it been well preserved, or was it pretty messed up?
Unfortunately, that theater is pretty much destroyed, in my opinion. There's very little plaster work left. The roof has gaping holes, and the last few times that I'd been there, the holes just seemed to be getting larger and larger. All the wire framing for the plaster is bare, basically, and coming down on its own. I went up to the, you know, projection booth, the balconies, and it's really, like I said, just beyond saving, in my opinion. It's just so trashed. There's no railings. The stairs are very dangerous. I would guess that from what I saw, the way some of the materials were piled up, that somebody was trying to salvage and possibly save some of the plaster work. There is a spot in the front lobby, you know, where you'd come in and buy your ticket, where there was actually some sizable chunks of the plaster still there, and seeing how the colors and how it was painted, and, you know, seeing some little just fraction of what it would have looked like, you know, while it was still in operation, even though it would have been towards the end and they might have done some cheesier type of repairs or paint jobs, just trying to get an idea of what it would have looked like and what it would have been like to go there and see a show.
So did you take anything from the theater? Do you ever take stuff from buildings?
No, I didn't. There's really nothing to take from the Palace Theater. The thing I noticed in Gary is there's really nothing to take from any of those buildings. They've been abandoned for so long that basically everything significant's been taken. In fact, a good example is that there's a hotel, actually, that encompasses the outside of the theater, I think the second and third story. And because the theater's in such a state of disrepair, you can walk through holes in the walls to get into the hotel side or apartment building side. Every single door, and there's just dozens and dozens of apartments, all the doorknobs and lock sets have been cut out. I mean, you could tell somebody went in there and sawed them all out. Bigger pieces of, you know, limestone carvings or whatever people have helped themselves to. The church, City Methodist Church, is a good example of that, where there was just gigantic limestone carvings, and you can see where a lot of them have been taken, and others that are just so huge, people tried to get them out of the building, and they couldn't quite get them out, so they just left them, you know, in the middle of a hallway or, you know, top of a staircase or whatever.
Thank you.
What was the real reason they closed the palace? And was it structural?
Just like
the water.
The downtown didn't have the business, I guess, and all the theaters, they were down to one or two, and the palace was one of the last ones. Then they remodeled it, and it only had special shows. I remember they had the Jackson 5 there. That was a special show a long time ago. The Marquis stayed up for years, on the Marquis for years after that show, because that
was a live show.
A live special show after the theaters had closed, but they had remodeled and opened it up, and that was one of the few shows that was there.
Then after they remodeled, they started doing theater then.
That didn't last too long because the downtown just wasn't...
Just tried something new and it couldn't hook it, huh?
Well, the whole downtown, you see what it is
now
compared to what it was then.
People too scared to go down.
Yeah, well, it wasn't so much scared, it's just the stores moved out. Everybody went to Maryville, the shopping malls, you know, they had malls outside of the city. And everybody was going to the malls, and that's where it was. Because I remember fellas I worked with years ago, Thursday nights and Monday nights, they knew their parents were going to take them downtown Gary for shopping. Crown Point was the county seat, but Gary was the center.
Hello, Gary. Do you read Gary?
We're looking for Gary.
Copy. This is Gary.
Yeah, this is
the reason they have the sign up that says Jackson 5 tonight, it's not like that's been around since the early 70s. That actually came in the late 1990s. It's been around for about 8 or 9 years since the Miss USA competition came to Gary. Donald Trump, when he owned the casino there, he also owns the rights to the Miss USA pageant, which is kind of like the sort of semi-poor cousin of the Miss America pageant that was originally held in Atlantic City. And as part of the deal, actually, for Trump to get the casino license, he agreed to bring the pageant there for 2 years to the Genesis Center in Gary, Indiana, which is just down the block from the Palace Theater, and it's just down the block from Broadway, where you see all of those abandoned buildings. Before the pageant came in, there was a sort of a sprucing up effort. Couldn't actually get businesses in there, but they went through and they painted a lot of the storefronts, put up marquees.
So to prepare for the pageant, they were trying to spruce up Broadway.
Right.
By, like, making it look like there was actually activity and life and color to these buildings that were actually pretty much shut down.
Well, you had all these contestants that were going up and down Broadway. There were actually no hotels in Gary, especially at the time, so there was no place for them to really stay in Gary, but they did go in and out of the Genesis Center there, which is right across from City Hall, and you did have camera crews coming in, so you needed something, I suppose, to make it look like, something was going on there.
So wait, there's no hotels in Gary?
There is a hotel now. There's a hotel that was built by Trump and the casino, and that's really it.
But there weren't any hotels at the time?
No, there were no hotels at the time. I think the Interstate Motel along 20 was the last motel in Gary. There are no movie theaters at this point in Gary.
There's none at all?
There are none at all. Crossroads was the last one that, way down on Broadway, close to Maryville, it closed a couple of years ago. The chain that owned it, I think, went under, and then there was a private operator for a little while, but then they went under as well. There are no major supermarket chains in Gary either. Other than sections of Miller and close to Maryville border, there's not a tremendous amount of economic activity going on here. It's quite a turnaround case.
That was Ghosts of Gary by Robin Amer. To hear more of Robin's stories about cities in transition, visit thirdcoastfestival.org and click on ReSound.
Misplaced bike.
Lost Chihuahua, 13 years old with a limp. Please help.
My son left his bike unattended and it was stolen.
Her name is Apricot. She also responds to Toddy.
If anyone knows who picked it up and could contact us, it would be greatly appreciated. I've been laid off and have been struggling to keep my head above water, so I can't get him a new one.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're listening to ReSound from the Third Coast Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. Tell us what you've lost or found. Questions, comments, rants, and raves can be sent to ReSound at thirdcoastfestival.org. Support for ReSound comes from Smoke Barbecue, serving authentic slow-smoked barbecue and homemade sides. Smoke caters events of all types and sizes throughout the Chicagoland area all year round. Check out their website at smokebbq.com. That's SMOQUEBBQ.com. Support also comes from Busy Beaver Button Company, your source for custom buttons, magnets, and bottle openers. All products proudly made in Chicago. Order online at busybeaver.net. Many stories are simply lost to the past. Small tales that might be a footnote in a textbook or anecdotes that escape the record altogether. Luckily for us, producer Nate DeMeo loves to unearth just such tidbits. This one begins in a little town in upstate New York in the 1840s, where two young sisters have just discovered a special talent.
People said the house was haunted. And that was even before the two girls started talking to the dead. Kate Fox was 11. Her older sister Margaret was just about marrying age, she was 14, when they moved into the little house in the Nothing Village, 40 miles east of Rochester, New York. The girls had moved around a lot in their short lives, particularly in the last several years since their mom left their dad, when dad's drinking got to be too much. But now they were all together again. Their father seemed to be on the wagon for good this time, and he had found enough work shoeing horses to afford the rent in the little house in Hydesville. And he probably got a pretty good deal, what with the ghost and all. Their neighbors would talk about the traveling salesman who had been invited inside years before and was never heard from again. Never heard from, that is, until one night in March of 1848, when Mr. and Mrs. Fox first heard the strange sounds coming from somewhere behind the living room wall. Some nights it would sound like knocking, other nights like furniture moving, and it always seemed to be coming from the bedroom their daughter shared. Their parents would run in, hoping to catch them mid-prank. But when they opened the door, the girls would be fast asleep. And they didn't believe that their daughters could be tricking them. These were just girls. But they were tricking them. What started with a little tap-tapping on the walls, and tiptoeing back into bed, a hand over a mouth, a face and a pillow suppressing giggles, got more and more sophisticated as the nights went on. The sisters found that if they tied twine around an apple, and tossed it across the room and quickly reeled it back in, the apple would skitter and skip along the floor and ricochet against the walls and furniture and sound an awful lot like the restless wandering of a murdered door-to-door salesman. And on the night of March 31st, the Fox sisters revealed the latest in their growing repertoire of ghost simulation techniques. They called their mother into the room and told her that Kate had made contact with the spirit. She then snapped her fingers once, and they heard a tap in response. She snapped twice, and it tapped twice. The next night, the Foxes, and all of their neighbors, squeezed into the girls' candlelit room and waited for the spirit. At dawn, the audience slipped out of the house, convinced that they had just spent the night in the presence of a dead man and two girls with incredible powers. Mr. and Mrs. Fox were scared. Their daughters could not stay in that room anymore, so they sent them to live with their older sister Leah and her family. Leah was responsible. She'd look after them. But they found that the ghost followed the girls, and Leah found an opportunity. Before long, thanks to Leah's management, the Fox sisters were selling out a 400-seat theater in Rochester. By 1850, the then 13-year-old Kate and the 16-year-old Margaret were the toast of New York City. People would wait in line for hours to buy tickets to see them, so they could ask the sisters to ask the spirit for word of their dead loved ones on the other side. The rich and famous would come backstage to meet the girls. The newspaperman Horace Greeley took them under his wing and introduced them to private clients who would pay the sisters to introduce them to the departed. Greeley also introduced them to New York nightlife, to the wine and whiskey that had nearly drowned their alcoholic father and destroyed their family. And in the pages of his newspaper, Greeley introduced the Fox sisters to the world. There were other mediums. There had been many other people who claimed to speak to the dead, But there was something about these sisters that people believed. They were innocent, pretty girls. And they were very, very good at what they were doing. They kept submitting to the challenges of skeptics and kept passing every test. Even people who were utterly convinced that this was all a trick couldn't explain how they did it. And everyone else, they wanted to believe. This was the 1850s. People just died all the time from diseases and minor flus and infections, things that don't kill us now. Their family members, their friends, their kids would die in childbirth, in accidents at work and at home. Why wouldn't they want to believe that those they loved weren't gone, that those they lost could be found? Soon people were holding seances like we hold dinner parties. They were putting their faith in tarot readers and mystics. Some were just scam artists, others were just wrong. They were just seeing things that weren't there. But all of them together were changing America and the way its people thought about death and life. And this modern spiritualism, that was Greeley's phrase, stayed near the center of American life for decades to come, even as it left the sisters who started it all behind. On October 21st, 1888, a 54-year-old Margaret Fox sat on the stage of the New York Academy of Music in front of 2,000 paying customers. And she spoke to the dead, and then she showed the audience how she spoke to the dead. She had recently lost her appetite for the whole business, and she wanted to get back at her older sister, Leah, whom she believed had been taking too big of a cut for years. So she told the people in the theater about how 40 years earlier, back in that little house in that nothing town, after a few nights of knocking and tiptoeing and tying strings to apples, she and her little sister realized that they could both crack their toes. They could just tense their feet and there would be this sound. And they found that no one could tell that they were doing it. And so people actually believed they were talking to the dead. And that was fun. She told them how they were happy to find out that that weird little sound could carry all the way to the back of a big theater. She told them how later, when they were famous, and fancy people would come to their fancy apartment on 42nd Street, a customer could be sitting all the way across the room from Margaret or Kate, and one of them would crack her toe, and the customer would be sure she was just tapped on the shoulder. Because sounds are hard to place in space, and because you'll pretty much believe anything if you really want to believe it. She revealed all of that, but not everything. There were some things that were private, some things that maybe she didn't even understand herself. So she didn't tell them about how both she and her little sister started to unravel, not long after Horace Greeley introduced them to the world, and to worldly things like power and wealth and wine, things that had brought down people far better prepared for them than two kids from way upstate. She didn't tell them about how she and her sister struggled under the growing weight of their shared secret. She didn't talk about the times that Kate went further and further with her claims, moving beyond toe-crack conversations to moving furniture, to making ghostly hands appear out of thin air, at least in the minds of desperate believers. Or how she couldn't be sure how much her increasingly erratic sister believed her own nonsense. And that night in the theater, at the age of 54, she certainly didn't tell them about the time she tested her own belief. In 1852, the fame and money and parties brought a man named Elijah Kent Kane to one of her seances. She was 18, he was 32, and handsome, and a celebrated Arctic explorer. So she fell in love with him. And he loved her, but he didn't love her profession. He was Catholic, and his family was very Catholic. And there was no way they were going to approve a union between their God-fearing son and this godless woman who was spreading blasphemy. So she gave it up, and she and Kane began an affair. And they were happy for a few years. And she was sure a marriage proposal would come any day, until the scurvy Kane had been fighting for years finally killed him in 1857. Margaret didn't tell the audience how she broke down one night, despondent and alone, and tried to contact her dead love, how she tried to do for real what she had spent the last decade pretending to do. She didn't tell them how she called out to him, and how he didn't call back, and how she sat in the dark, knowing that he never would, and knowing that she would never be able to feel the comfort that the people who paid to see the sisters felt when they heard that their loved ones were at peace, or that they had been forgiven, or that they were always the one, of course they were, or that they would never be forgotten. Kate and Margaret Fox weren't forgotten, but at the times of their deaths, they weren't remembered fondly. Each died poor, neither living to see 50. The people who still clung to spiritualism weren't glad to see them go, and the people who never believed, they were too. Now, there's a postscript here that really can't be resisted, and you can do with it what you will. In 1904, they tore down that little house in that nothing town, and inside one of the walls, near what had been the girl's room, they found the skeleton of a man believed to be a traveling salesman who appeared to have been murdered a few years before the Fox family moved in.
The Sisters Fox by Nate DeMayo. Check out more little historical gems courtesy of the Memory Palace podcast at thirdcoastfestival.org.
Private investigator will find your lost relatives or other lost loved ones.
Lost father.
Found blue ball.
Trying to locate my father, who was named John.
PI will find hard-to-locate persons. Very reasonable rates.
Found a 16-inch blue ball rolling down Elm Street during the Wednesday night storm.
May even take partial barter.
Every once in a while, we invite musician Abraham Levitan to join us at the end of our show for a ReSound wrap-up song.
It's Abraham's ReSound song. It's the ReSound wrap-up song.
His specialty is writing songs on the spot. We give him a little more time than a spot. We give him a few days. Today's composition reflects on all of what you just heard. The story of a fading language in Last Words from Hopi High, reminiscing and recreating in Waiting for Godot in New Jersey, a city in decline in Ghosts of Gary, and clairvoyance pulling the wool over everyone's eyes in The Sisters Fox. His song is called Beautiful When We Were Young.
May you die in Act 5, Scene 3. May your kids learn the native tongue. My sister and me haunt the streets of Gary. We were beautiful when we were young. Me and my sister, we talk to the dead. We find out exactly how Sam Beckett read. We break into the palace, we're performing live. It's the ghosts of the Jackson Five. When our dead brothers come back, we'll all form a line. If we can speak their language, they'll let us all fine. But just when they'll appear, don't nobody know. It's like waiting for Godot. May you die in Act 5, Scene 3. May your kids learn the native tongue. My sister and me haunt the streets of Gary. When we were young, I fell asleep in the lobby. Didn't get home till 4. Danced in my dreams with a Dillinger's ghost. Man, my mother was so. So I died in Act 3, so my kids never learned my tongue. My sister and me haunt the streets of Gary. We were beautiful when we were young. We were beautiful.
Beautiful When We Were Young, a ReSound wrap-up song from contributor Abraham Levitan. For more information about Abraham's projects, including his live game show, Shame That Tune, his music teaching group, Piano Power, and his rock band, Baby Teeth, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. ReSound is a production of the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. The program is produced by Katie Mingle and curated by Johanna Zorn and Julie Shapiro of the Third Coast Festival. You can hear today's program at thirdcoastfestival.org, where you can also hear hundreds of outstanding documentaries from around the world and subscribe to our podcast. Support for ReSound comes from Dojo, a full-service digital agency, on the web at doejo.com. Dojo, we fuel ideas that grow. Support for ReSound also comes from Kate Joyce, devoted to documentary and architectural photography, specializing in commissions and collaborations with an installation of aerial photographs currently on view at RTKL Chicago Gallery at 200 South Michigan Avenue through October 31st. More at www.kate-joyce.com. The Third Coast Festival is a nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Boeing Company Charitable Trust, the Agudino Foundation, and the Menaki Foundation. This program is partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. Special thanks to our many individual contributors from Chicago and around the world. If you want to contact us, we would love to hear from you. Email us at resound@thirdcoastfestival.org. ReSound returns next week with more radio that you can't hear anywhere else unless you live everywhere else.
You've been listening to the Third Coast Podcast. Stay connected with us through Facebook and Twitter, or by signing up for our email list at thirdcoastfestival.org. If you like what you heard today, consider writing us a review on iTunes or sending us a few bucks. As always, thanks for listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.